In the fall of 2003, I was a visiting scholar in Uppsala at the Department of Philosophy. And while I was there, I took part in a discussion group where we read philosophical investigations from the beginning. At one of the meetings, was started by Per Segerdahl, who had prepared a short introduction. Most of you here know Per Segerdahl, and some of those who were present at the meeting are also present here today. We had at this meeting reached section 8 of the PI, and I have chosen to let the main points of his introduction serve as the starting point for what I'm going to say here today. Before I move on, I want to point out that Segerdahl presented his introduction at an informal meeting, and it's possible that he pushed certain points for the sake of discussion. Segerdahl suggested that we should make a comparison between Section 8 in the PI and some remarks in the Tractatus. In Section 8, we find an expansion of Language 2, or the language games. Language game in Section 2, with the two builders, A and B, their building blocks and four words or calls or names. Let us look at Section 8. It's number 1 on the handout. Let us now look at an expansion of Language 2. Besides the four words block, pillar, etc., let it contain a series of words used as the shopkeeper in 1 used the numerals. It may be the series of letters of the alphabet. Further, let there be two words, which may as well be there and this, because this roughly indicates their purpose, that are used in connection with a pointing gesture. And finally, a number of color samples. A gives an order like D, slab, there. At the same time, he shows the assistant a color sample, and when he says there, he points to a place on the building site. From the stock of slabs, D takes 1 for each letter of the alphabet up to D, of the same color as the sample, and brings them to the place indicated by A. On other occasions, A gives the order this there. At this, he points to a building stone, and so on. Segerdahl wanted us to notice that the section contains a description of a rudimentary handling of words that is almost demonstratively detailed. He then compared Section 8 to the following remarks or extracts of remarks from the Tractatus. This is also on the handout under 1. The existence and non-existence of atomic facts is the reality. To the objects correspond in the picture the elements of the picture. The general form of proposition is such and such is the case. According to how Segerdahl presented it, these remarks from the Tractatus treat of the essence of language, of how it must be and what there must be before we can investigate empirical matters. He described the remarks as extremely general theses that express an ideal conception of language. He further suggested that if the young Wittgenstein had to read Section 8 of the PI, he would have been very impatient and frustrated, since there is, Segerdahl claimed, no trace of generality in the section. But instead we find a detailed description of particular things, actions, and circumstances. Our wish to idolize when philosophizing is meant to be frustrated when we read Section 8. As if the almost ritual attention to details is to function as a cure against our urge to idolize and present dogmatic statements about language. Segerdahl also suggested that Wittgenstein is here making fun of his earlier self in a friendly way. According to Segerdahl, it is hence possible that Section 8 is intentionally extreme and almost absurd in its inclusion of details and particulars, as if including enough trivialities will make the ideal shade away and lose its attraction on us. As far as I can see, Segedal uses the assumption that Wittgenstein in the Tractatus is engaged in an investigation directed at reaching truths about the essence of language and at presenting theses about how the world and language must be related. He assumes, in other words, that Wittgenstein's aim in the Tractatus is to reach insight into extremely general metaphysical matters. At least this is how I understand Segedal. If we accept this view of the Tractatus, the comparison Segedal made certainly brings out a contrast. It seems clear from the examples we looked at that Wittgenstein operates at a very general level in the Tractatus, and that an ideal conception of language is at the center of his investigation there. Section 8, on the other hand, comes into view as an illuminating example of how the late Wittgenstein's focus has shifted to things that would seem trivial to the author of the Tractatus. If we use Segedal's perspective, the section almost appears to be a list of details and particulars. The view that it is characteristic of Wittgenstein's method in the PI to describe particular circumstances that belong to specific cases is, I believe, widely accepted, and it is, in a sense, quite uncontroversial of Segedal to highlight this aspect of his philosophy. And given the assumptions that were used, the contrast between Wittgenstein's way of doing philosophy in the two works comes out as quite compelling, I thought. But there are, of course, other ways of looking at the examples. And after our discussion in the group, I had the feeling that something important had been left out. And I continued to think about it, and two things occupied my mind. The first was that, in line with how Section 8 was presented, Segedal had said that there is no trace of generality in the section. The second thing was the way in which he had spoken of trivialities. He had used the word to indicate details, particulars, and insignificant circumstances. That the words trivial and trivialities also are used in other ways was not brought into our discussion. And the words stood out as important, I thought, in view of certain passages from Wittgenstein's writings, where he uses these words when speaking of what we say and what we find out in philosophy. And I was thinking of the following passages. They are under number 2 on the handout. What we find out in philosophy is trivial. It does not teach us new facts. Only science does that. But the proper synopsis of these trivialities is enormously difficult and has immense importance. Philosophy is, in fact, the synopsis of trivialities. Philosophy will in the end consist of utterly trivial propositions, remarks. It is, however, enormously difficult to achieve such an understanding of them. That is, to understand them as the philosophy. This comment may be trivial, like all the comments we shall make, but what is not trivial is seeing them all together. I wanted to make the different uses of the word trivial and trivialities clear to myself, in order to better see how these uses could be connected to the comparison that Segedal had suggested. I also wanted to look at the etymology of the words, since I find that this often produces new ways of looking at problems. For this purpose, I consulted various dictionaries. And the etymology of trivial might seem straightforward, trivial in a sense, and it's probably well known to you. But here's what I found. And you might look at one page. So, the list of things I found in dictionaries are on one of the pages. The word trivial stems from trivium, that is tri, which means three, and via, which means road. The word has been used to indicate a crossroad where three roads meet, or further, a street corner, or a place of public resort. The term trivium was also used to indicate the three first of seven disciplines that were taught in medieval universities. The three most elementary disciplines, referred to as trivium, consisted of grammar, rhetorics, and logic. And let us now turn to different meanings of the word trivial. The Oxford English Dictionary, OED, tells us that the word may be used in the following ways. And I will point out examples to you. It's number 2-5. Such as may be met with anywhere. Common, commonplace, ordinary, everyday, familiar, trite. And 6a, of small account, little esteemed, paltry, inconsiderable, unimportant. And the next point is mathematics, of no consequence or interest, for example, because equal to zero, satisfying a given relation on a set with every member of the set. Other English dictionaries report that trivial is also used in the sense of evident, obvious, and dull. And Princeton University's WordNet, it's on the other side of the handout, tells us that in hackish, which is the jargon used by hackers, trivial is used to mean I have seen it before, or to indicate a problem that one has already solved. In the German dictionary, Barit, I found trivial, ordinary, without valuable content, trite, hackneyed, familiar to the tiresome, shallow. Since the word was imported into the German language from French, I also checked my Petit Robert, and it had the following to say about trivial. Trivial, known by everyone, and an old-fashioned meaning is that which has become ordinary, trite and common, a trivial style opposed to a noble sublime. The current meaning in French, that which is characteristic of the lowest element of society, what is contrary to good manners. And it can also mean that which designates openly and in a popular manner realities which should be left in silence according to good tone. Petit Robert lists the antonyms exceptional, rare, distinguished, noble, sublime. And the listings for trivialities was very little informative. It says, the OED says only that it means trivialities, trifles, things of little consequence, or useless information in allusion to the quiz game. Whereas the Petit Robert deviates and tells us that it is the character of that which is banal and trite, but also the character of that which is coarse, vulgar. The way Segedal used the word trivialities corresponds to the listings that tells us that it means things of little importance or consequence, trivial matters. The triviality of the matters that Wittgenstein speaks of in section 8 was presented as tied to their particularity, but the other listings found in the dictionaries and the etymology of the words do not point in the direction of particularity, but indicate, as I see, that trivial and trivialities are also used to signify generality of some kind. And it is possible that when Wittgenstein says that his comments are trivial, he uses this word in some such sense, that is, that he uses it to indicate some form of generality. If this is so, the question is how we are to understand the kind of generality that is brought out in his later philosophy. Before we approach this question, it should be mentioned that the picture we were given by Segedal, according to which it is characteristic of the later Wittgenstein not to operate at the general level and to focus on the particular, seems reasonable if we consider, for instance, what he says in the Blue Book when he speaks about our craving for generality as a source of philosophical confusion, and when he describes our urge to explain a variety of cases by a small number of hypotheses and laws as another source of confusion. His comment about how the philosopher only can find a way out of his confusions by studying that which he tends to ignore, the particular case, could also be seen as suggesting that Segedal is right to emphasize the central role of the particular case in Wittgenstein's philosophy. And if we consider remarks like those from the Blue Book, It may seem as if Wittgenstein recommends us only to study and describe in detail particular cases, one particular case, then move on to the description of another. This appears to be a method which would be in accordance with the remarks from the Blue Book, and further, a method which is in line with Wittgenstein's remarks about philosophy as purely descriptive. To proceed in this manner, from one description of a particular case to another, would be, it seems, a safe route that could guarantee that we avoid operating at a general level and thereby also avoid the confusions that could arise were we to involve generality in our investigations. But the generality Wittgenstein speaks of in the Blue Book is the one that is sought in science, where one wants to explain and describe a large number of different cases by way of a law or a hypothesis which is expressed in a general proposition. A main point with propositions of this kind, or laws of this kind, is that they are meant to apply regardless of what particular circumstances that may hold. It is also important that such general propositions have the same meaning regardless of what context it is used in. The importance of linguistic expressions with a constant meaning in science may, for instance, be seen when a social scientist carries out an investigation using a quantitative method. As a rule, this involves selecting a large number of persons that are assumed to be representative of the population, ask them questions that are formulated in such a way that the possibility of different interpretations is minimized. And he would present them with answers, a few alternative answers for each question that the selected persons have to choose between. Once the answers are collected, the material is registered and analyzed. The result is an overview, which can be presented in various diagrams and tables. And the overview is to a large degree based on counting the number of answers that have been chosen among the possible ones to the questions that were asked. The representative and large selection from the population, the unambiguity or attempted unambiguity of the questions and answers, and the method used when the material is handled are meant to ensure that the conclusions that are drawn have general validity. It seems clear that Wittgenstein's investigation in the PI is not aimed at reaching generality in this manner or of this kind, and that the overview he speaks of is not of the character as the one that was reached in social science. But if we assume that Wittgenstein uses the words trivial or trivialities in the quoted passages that I quoted in the beginning, in some such sense that indicates generality, we must ask how this generality is brought out. And we may now approach this question bearing the different meanings of trivial and related words in mind. So let's take another look at what Wittgenstein does in the PI. He presents a series of examples. At least this is a main part of what he does. The description of an example includes a number of particular circumstances that hold of that specific case. We may, like Segedal, say that by doing so, he includes a number of trivialities in his descriptions, and that this strategy is used by Wittgenstein because he wants to remain at the level of particularity. But one might call something a triviality for different reasons, and let me present two examples to illustrate what I mean. I have arranged to meet a friend at a restaurant in the outskirts of town. It's difficult to get there and there are no buses, etc. When he arrives, I ask him, "How did you get here?" He says, "I took a taxi. It was a blue Mercedes, year model 98 or 99. The driver wore glasses and had a green sweater on." In this case, we could say that my friend includes trivialities in his answer. The details he mentions concern only this particular instance of taking a taxi. We have all taken taxis, but not all of us have ridden in a car of this color and model, driven by somebody in clothes of this color. It is difficult to understand why he tells me about these things. They seem irrelevant to the question I ask. Another example would be the following. I meet a professor at a conference and ask politely, "How was your morning?" The professor tells me that he had a fine morning. He got up, had breakfast, then brushed his teeth, flossed, put on his dress jacket, and went down to the conference room. In this case, we could say that the professor speaks of trivialities in a different sense than in the example with the taxi car. The activities he speaks of, that he brushed his teeth and flossed in the morning, are trivial in the sense that they are in no way exceptional for him. The things he includes in his answers are instead everyday matters, things that are so familiar to us that we rarely speak about them. They belong to a routine that looks more or less the same for most people. The difference between the two examples that I wanted to point out is that my friend who has taken a taxi speaks of trivialities because he mentions particular things of little importance that only concern that specific case. The professor who brushes his teeth, what he talks about, on the other hand, are not trivialities because they hold up a particular case only. Instead, they may be called trivialities because they are ordinary or familiar to the tiresome. Now, in the PI, Wittgenstein presents descriptions of particular cases, and when he describes the cases of language use, he includes details that belong to the context. Segedar suggested that particulars or trivialities are used in order to avoid generality. And if he by generality means the kind of generality which is sought in science, I think he's right. But we could also say that Wittgenstein uses triviality for the purpose of bringing out another kind of generality in the following way. By focusing on the variety of particular circumstances, actions, and details that our language use is woven into, he brings trivialities into the foreground and makes them clearly visible. They are trivialities because they are ordinary, everyday things, or patterns in our use of language. Sometimes, such as in the example with the builders in section 2, Wittgenstein presents almost a caricature of such a pattern in our use of language. That is, to call out for something whereupon someone else gives it to you. This ordinary way of using words is presented in relief. And in this sense, Wittgenstein is like the professor who tells people that he has brushed his teeth. What he describes is exceedingly familiar. By presenting his examples in this manner, Wittgenstein brings out what is general to the front, both because he highlights the variety of aspects in the surroundings in which language is used, but also because he brings patterns, ways of using words that are repeated to our attention. And here we might look at what he says in the big typescript, exposed number 4. I think I will not read it. Okay, fine reading. Now, I would like to make a detour to a text where Wittgenstein's focus is on utterances or propositions that are trivial in the sense of elementary or non-informative. The text is the same as the previous speaker spoke about, uncertainty. And Wittgenstein discusses, as you know, utterances like, "The earth already existed long before my birth. Every human being has parents. There are various cities." What is expressed in these propositions, and I will call them that, are things that are known by everyone. They are evident, obvious, they are trivial. Their triviality is hence connected to their generality. A main point in Wittgenstein's discussion in uncertainty is that in most contexts, it would be strange to make such trivial statements. When Wittgenstein draws our attention to this difficulty, it is, of course, connected to the intimate connection between the meaning of a word and the context in which it is used, that we find in his philosophy. But he also indicates that we have here a form of generality that has a role in our lives and it is found in our practices, and that it cannot in an unproblematic way be made explicit in propositions. When we try to do that, our utterances become strange, becomes unclear what they mean or whether they have meaning, such as in the example from Uncertainty 461, it's number 5 in the handout, with a man who goes to the doctor, shows his hand and says, "This thing that looks like a hand isn't just a superb imitation, it really is a hand." Now, I would like to see this in connection with what Wittgenstein says in section 128 in PI about thesis in philosophy. The famous remark number reads, "If one tried to advance thesis in philosophy, it would never be possible to debate them because everyone would agree to them." I would like to suggest that the possible way of reading the remark is that Wittgenstein, when he speaks of philosophical thesis, thinks of utterances that are trivial in the sense he indicates by saying, and here I think the English translation is not very good, it says, "It would never be possible to debate them." I think a better translation is, "No discussion would arise." So my suggestion is that he thinks of utterances that are trivial in the sense that no discussion would arise. Just as when somebody says things like, "The earth is a body on whose surface we move," or "There are various cities." Let's compare the point Wittgenstein makes in Uncertainty and the way he makes it to how generality is thought in science. Like I said before, it is important for the scientific activity that the general laws that are used may be taken to hold and have the same meaning regardless of what particular circumstances it is presented in or used in. The ideal, at least, is a law whose validity and meaning does not vary in different circumstances. To express the generality one seeks in propositions and assign them a status as generally valid is to the point for the aims that the scientific activity is directed at. And within this context, such propositions have a clear use. Another characteristic feature of a scientific investigation is that when experiments are carried out, when seeking laws or testing hypotheses, one often tries to create an environment where one relational phenomenon may be studied in isolation. One wants to neutralize or remove factors during the experiment other than those that are studied. The ideal situation in which to test, for instance, Galileo's law for the velocity of falling bodies is to let something fall inside a vacuum. If the experiment is carried out without a vacuum or even outdoors, there are methods that make it possible to make calculations where the effective factors such as air resistance or wind are subtracted in order to reach a result that would have been obtained if the body had fallen in a vacuum. The particular circumstances, the context, in other words, that surround that which is studied are in this way often conceived of as elements of disturbance during the scientific activity. What is considered important with regard to the generality one seeks is often to try to reach a situation where an object can be studied in its pure form. And the idea would be to observe it without context, or a context which consists only of the factors that the scientist is interested in. And there are, of course, clear similarities between the example that I described from science and the method that, for instance, Descartes uses in order to reach something absolutely certain. He gradually takes away aspects or parts of the context that he finds himself in until all that is left as certain is that he thinks, and he can present the result of his investigation in a proposition. Wittgenstein's approach to philosophical questions and the way he brings out the form of generality he seeks might be described as the reverse of these methods. And it could be said that Wittgenstein openly designates realities that should be left in silence, as the Petiro Barra wrote, according then to norms and standards that hold when the method of science is used as a model for the philosophical investigation. Let's now return to the PI and the suggestion that it is characteristic of the investigation carried out there to focus on the particular in order to avoid generality. It was suggested that when Wittgenstein presents an example, his description is intentionally free of generality. And it, of course, he does present descriptions of particular cases. But it will be useful here to take a look at how he characterizes this way of approaching philosophical questions in a passage from this past Schlick. And this is the second number five on the handout, two. Wittgenstein says, "I cannot characterize my position better than by saying that it is the opposite position of the one Socrates represents in the Platonic dialogues. For if somebody asked me what knowledge is, I would list examples of knowledge and add the words and similar things. No constituent part common to them all can be found, since there is none." In the quoted passage, Wittgenstein says that he would answer the question, what is knowledge, by a list of examples. And his book, The PI, may of course be seen as such an answer to the question, what is language, as well as to other questions. But what I want to focus on here is that at the end of the list of examples, Wittgenstein would add, and similar things. The examples that he presents in the PI are, as we know, presented as part of a series of examples, and it is a series that we are able to continue. We can construct other examples, similar things, on the analogy of the examples that he has given. The fact that we are able to do so, to continue, is connected to the fact that the examples Wittgenstein presents often are such that we recognize the ways of using language that he describes. He describes trivialities in the sense that we have seen it before. Naturally, this cannot be said of all of his examples, and here I have in mind those where he makes other practices than ours. But I think that we are often made aware of, for instance, the role a concept has in our practices by the imagined examples. And here I'm thinking, for instance, of men who only show pity when someone is bleeding and otherwise laugh at the expression of pain, from TI 599. You can see the addition to the list of examples in the quote from Diktat für Schlick and similar things in connection with another remark from section 208 in the PI. He says there, and this is number 6 on the handout, "The gesture that means go on like this and or and so on has a function comparable to that of pointing to an object or place. We should distinguish between the and so on which is and the and so on which is not an abbreviated notation. And so on ad infinitum is not such an abbreviation. Teaching which is not meant to apply to anything but the examples given is different from that which points beyond them." Given that the example Wittgenstein presents in the PI are not given only so that we can study them one by one as descriptions of particular circumstances that hold only of a specific case, but that they are presented as part of a series, ended with an and so on, we may say that his examples point beyond the ones he has given. And one aspect of the generality which is brought out in his investigation is found in this pointing beyond. The possibility of continuing and in the possibility of continuing the series. And the fact that we are able to do so, as I said, has got to do with the triviality of the examples. He does not show us anything new. Instead, we remember that we already used words in this way. This is from Big TypeScript, page 419. We can shed light on what Wittgenstein means when he says that the synopsis of the trivialities that we find out in philosophy is not trivial, if we consider what he says in the Brown Book, and this is number 7. Wittgenstein presents a contrast here between the method he uses and to investigate the meaning of a word in a way similar to stripping an artichoke of its leaves in order to find the real artichoke. It has been argued, of course, that it should be an onion instead in this scenario. But I have no particular comment on that. The stripping of the artichoke brings the scientific experiment to mind, or Descartes' method in his search for certain knowledge. Wittgenstein compares the method he uses to showing someone a set of family portraits in order to give an idea of the facial characteristics of a certain family. The main task, he says, would be to find a proper arrangement of the pictures which makes it possible to see, and I quote, how certain influences gradually change the features, in what characteristic ways the members of the family aged, what features appeared most strongly as they did so. I have chosen to include this extremely familiar example of how Wittgenstein speaks of his method for two reasons. First of all, I think that the way he presents the comparison of his method by examples to a set of family portraits in this passage indicates that if we think of an example in the PI, such as the one in section 8, as an example that we are to study for its own sake only, that would be similar to looking at only at one portrait, at one picture. The single picture will tell us a lot about that particular family member, but it will not show us what characteristic features there are within the family. Wittgenstein's emphasis on the importance of arranging the pictures properly for the purpose of making characteristic features visible also sheds light on how he proceeds in order to bring out generality in his investigation, and on the character of the synopsis, the overview his trivial remarks form. The comparison Segedal made at the meeting of the discussion group was between the Tractatus and the PI. The contrast was between a young Wittgenstein who focuses on presenting general truths and a later Wittgenstein who focuses on the particular. As you have noticed, I have chosen to focus on what Wittgenstein does in the PI in this talk. But I want to end by drawing your attention to the fact that given the different ways in which the word trivial is used on related words, it may very well be used to describe remarks in the Tractatus. We could, for instance, look at Frege's comments on the Tractatus in letters sent to Wittgenstein. In the last of the letters that have been preserved from 1920, Frege comments on the first remark of the book, "The world is everything that is the case." Frege says that its sense is unclear to him. He assumes that it expresses an identity, but wonders whether he should understand it as a definition, and he goes on to ask, "Do you want to say, I understand," it's number 8, "I understand by world everything that is the case, then the world is the defined expression. Everything that is the case, the defining expression. In this case, nothing is thereby asserted of the world or of that which is the case. Rather, if something is supposed to be asserted, then it is something about the author's use of language. Whether and how far this use might concur with the language of daily life is a separate matter, which is, however, of little concern to the philosopher once he has established his use of language." Frege's puzzlement over the first remark, as I understand it, has got to do with his expectation to find a scientific theory in the book, but what he finds there deviates radically from what he conceives of as science or scientific discourse. It is clear that Frege is puzzled by the fact that the first remark in the Tractatus appears to be non-informative. It seems to lack content, or at least content that is relevant to philosophy. The remark is trivial, as far as he can see. That was the whole thing.
Thank you.